Hi, I'm Andre Anader, and I'm a public health nutrition researcher at RTI International. And first, I want to say I'm impressed that this many, I consider you all the public health marathoners that couldn't be stopped by a storm or a parade, I almost was, and stuck it out to this last scientific session. So that's impressive. So today, what I'm going to be talking about is a specific study that targets a part or targets food security, which we know, I imagine most of us know, is disproportionately suffered by lower income, lower SES, and minority populations. So I think that was the fit here. And I'm going to start with admiring the problem, and then hopefully we'll get to the start of some solutions. Okay, so just to get us all on the same page and start, what is food security? Food security is defined as access by all household members at all times to enough food for a healthy, active life. Conversely, then, food insecurity, which is what we'll be talking about, is limited or uncertain availability of nutritionally adequate and safe foods or uncertain ability to acquire those foods in socially acceptable ways. So while starvation seldom occurs in this nation of abundance, many individuals do suffer, and we hear a lot about this at Thanksgiving time coming up, from the limited or uncertain ability to acquire nutritionally adequate and safe foods. So, some statistics. Every year, the current population survey puts out new numbers about the food security status of the nation. And what they reported for 2011 is that 14.9% of the population was food insecure, so that's one in six individuals. 6.9 million were very low food secure, meaning that the food intake of some household members was reduced or the normal eating patterns were disrupted at some point over the last 12 months. So this group made up about one-third of all those households. 50 million people in the U.S. for whom hunger was a reality, 17 million of those were children. So this very low food security rate has continually increased over the past decade, despite a lot of goals that have been put in place to, you know, 2015 we're supposed to eradicate childhood hunger. But in fact, what we're seeing is that over the past decade, from 2001 to 2011, there was actually a jump of about 72% in food insecurity, very low food insecurity. These numbers of very food it's a tongue twister, of very food insecure, varied quite a bit across population groups. So we see that those with children and those below the federal poverty line, households headed by single women or single men, Black, non-Hispanic, and Hispanics, and as we might expect, incomes below 185% of poverty, tended to have disproportionately high numbers. Also, it should be noted that the numbers are typically quite a bit higher in the South, where I come from in North Carolina. I think it's about 18%, and also in rural areas or further away from larger cities. Okay. And folks always ask me, well, why do we care? And, you know, a lot of folks will care because they believe it's a moral imperative or their faith tells them that they ought to care. But what I like to tell folks is it's not an individual problem, that nutritional adequacy is the single most important determinant of health, and chronic or intermittent food insecurity is incompatible with good health and, broadly speaking, results in hunger, malnutrition, increased susceptibility to diseases, quality of life, and may reduce longevity overall. In the U.S., food insecurity is estimated to cost Americans about $167 billion dollars a year for malnutrition, hospitalizations, lost job opportunities, diminished outcomes in education, childhood cognitive, real effects on cognitive learning abilities, absenteeism, suicide, depression, and cost of charities to try to address food aid. So that's, if it doesn't go as a moral imperative, we say social and economically it's necessary for sustainability. Okay. What my research looks to do is say, well, what do individuals do to cope with this? So I would hear a lot of times while I worked with the SNAP program, anecdotally, that people were really struggling to get by. but we don't have images here that we see on TV of internationally with these very malnourished people. We tend to see the paradoxical overweight. So I was trying to figure out, well, they're telling me that their SNAP benefits or their WIC and their other programs aren't sufficient. Well, what are they doing? So what I did was I set out to identify those individual types of coping strategies that are used to ensure sufficient food for the households. And I actually, while doing this, came up with three types of individual level responses. Participating in the federal programs, and these programs started already back in 1946. These safety nets were created. The first one was the school lunch program designed to ensure that we had well enough nourished population to participate in war. It was actually a military security issue. There's all kinds of other programs that we have to free up our financial resources to extend more money toward food. Tax credits, housing, medical. And currently, one in four Americans participates in one of 15 federal feeding assistance programs. And what you have below that I'm showing you is that 52% of these households that receive the benefits were still food insecure. And 23% of the households that received SNAP were still very low food secure. So to supplement that, we also have this whole system of private hunger relief organizations. This is like Feeding America food banks, soup kitchens, food pantries, backpack programs. And then thirdly, what I primarily study are these individual types of responses, the types of things that individuals do to ensure that they have sufficient money or sufficient to buy food or to actually increase their food amount. And unlike the other two, they don't tend to be formally organized responses. And, that's a lot of ands, people tend to use a combination of all three of these to ensure that sufficient household food. So we talked a little bit about this. This is what my study looked to do that I'm going to talk about today, to try to find out what are these strategies that people are using and to identify them. So a study at Rutgers University identified 78 of these strategies and sorted them into five risk categories, which you can see there: financial, food safety, illegal, regulatory, nutritional, physical, and no risk. And we'll give some examples as we go. And some of these strategies that we identified were as common as using coupons, buying items when they're on sale, buying products in bulk, things that you or I may do. But we have to remember that they were all contextualized because you're worried about having sufficient food. Others were a lot more extreme, and we'll get to those. You know, engaging in prostitution, going to prison for a short time to get meals, eating out of dumpsters, living in abandoned buildings to free up resources. What this study that we're talking about did was it said, okay, we identified 78 of these. Well, let's find out if these are public health concern. Let's try to quantify them, figure out what those prevalence are, and then connect them to these risks. Because otherwise, you know, it's unfortunate that people are using them, but they may not need to be addressed. So we designed a study. It was cross-sectional in design. There were 50 emergency food providers randomly selected throughout the state of New Jersey from two types, food pantries or soup kitchens. They were proportionally allocated by type, and 10 clients of those services were interviewed at each place. So we used a two-stage random sampling strategy and ended up with a total of 492 individuals. For the analysis, it was both, this was still exploratory. The study was designed as trying to understand the psychosocial and sociodemographic factors that might influence these as well as quantifying them. So we used two types of strategies following bivariate analysis to generate models. We wanted to find out if there were any predictive characteristics that could tell you who was more likely to do these risky things. We initially sorted the strategies by participation in any of the risk categories, and then we actually used cut points to try to increase the likelihood of noticing some difference. Okay, we're going to speed up. And I know you can't see this, but it was a way of trying to get a lot of information in a short space. Just to talk real quickly about the sample, because this is an SES and health disparities group. 66% of the sample were women. Average age was about 50. The population turned out to be evenly divided between black and white, with only 12% actually reporting Latino, being Latino. We'll skip through the education. 82% of the sample was food insecure as defined by the USDA measure. We're not going to go into more of that, but just keep in the back of your mind that 18% of this group, even though they were using soup kitchens and food pantries where we sampled them, were technically classified by the USDA as food secure. And the distribution of the sample demographically, that's all this is trying to show, was fairly, as we would have expected, distributed and spread across those food security categories. Actually, we'll just go quickly through that. But there were some noticeable differences that I wanted to highlight. The very low food secure category had an extremely, a much lower than expected income level, and a much lower than expected highest income level. And this was similar for participation in the government programs. We'll talk about why that's important. These were the strategies that they used, the distribution of them. There were 9,500 strategies, non-unique strategies identified. This shows how they were distributed by risk categories, with the largest chunk being in that nutritional category, 33%. These are some examples of strategies by risk categories. Nutritionally is under or over nourishment, 59% reported skipping meals, diluting foods or drinks, which is like baby formula. Financially, not paying bills, 41% reported that, or establishing store credit. And then we move into those more illegal type of begging, switching price tags on food, selling your WIC vouchers, et cetera. What this is intended to show, and you only have to see the lines, is that very top red line is that very low food secure group. Those are the people that used to be classified as hungry. That next one down is low food security, which is those two categories are what the USDA calls food insecure. Next, marginal, and that very bottom is high food security. What I'm intending for this to show is, so down the left, or the y-axis are participants, and down the x are some of the behaviors. Don't worry about seeing those. That slope of participation, that spread between groups, and how extended it is even between those two categories within that are classified as food insecure. That very low is participants were six times more likely to do most of the behaviors than even their closest group, whereas the other ones cling more closely together. So when we got into trying to predict what folks were more likely to do, we assumed they're probably that very low food secure group, given that they are participating in so many more behaviors and so many more risky behaviors. We expected them then to factor into very low food security status to factor in as a predictor. And it did. Okay. So as you can see, when we just sorted by participation in any of the coping strategies, using any of these individually developed, at least one of them within the categories, we saw that very low food security and having any children increased your chances of doing something financially risky. In terms of illegal, substance abuse or having any children. Physical substance abuse, again, or having unstable housing, which means you're moving between folks' couches or living in shelters or you don't have a fixed address for a period of time. When we looked at our more robust predictive values and increased established thresholds, so you have participated in at least three financially risky, we saw abusing a substance, being a member of a very low food secure household, and participating in a child feeding assistance program predicted financial risk. Nutritional behaviors were so risky, there were so many of them, you had to do at least 10. And here we try to show that those factors that increased your likelihood of engaging in these different nutritionally risky strategies. Illegal, male substance abuse, very low food security, participating in SNAP. Physical, they were somewhat rare, so we didn't actually establish a threshold there. Substance abuse or having unstable housing, food safety, substance abuse, and very low food security. So as expected, very low food security showing up over and over. So in summary, since I know you couldn't have followed those that fast, emergency food provider clients, these are the food pantry or soup kitchen ones, who are very low food insecurity, food secure substance abuse users will be the most likely to use risky food safety strategies. Those same two and who receive food assistance for their children are more likely to use financially risky ones. And again, very low food security female and substance abusers of an ethnicity that is not white or African American. This is the only time ethnicity or race showed up as a predictive value and receive assistance for their children were more likely to use nutritionally risky ones. And very low food secure male substance abuse users receiving SNAP are most likely to engage in illegal strategies. And then lastly, substance abuse users in unstable housing most likely to do physically risky things. So what do we do with this? Well, first of all, the whole intention of this was, first of all, to find out what folks are doing feeling like the current USDA scale categorizes folks into these rudimentary categories, but you don't have the direct behaviors that are being used. It's largely an economic measure. So this gives approaches, as we go through this data, for figuring out how can you target specific groups that are most likely to use those riskiest ones and respond to them with either ones behaviors that are not as risky, you know, alternatives that we also see that are being done, or focus more concerted efforts through policies toward them. Actually gives you a way to have actionable information to deal with the 50 million food insecure folks. And the big themes that we saw coming out over and over are those very low food security are more likely to use all of the strategies and the most risky, and those substance abuse users and those worst off really disproportionately using things. So that was my role. And oh, what's next for this? I just wanted to show this really quickly. We're currently working on a study. This just highlighted a little tiny bit of what we collected in that past one, that's trying to understand the interplay of those three types of coping strategies, how that affects things. So what difference does it make if you're receiving feeding or financial assistance, a safety net program? What difference does it make if you're participating in private hunger relief organizations? What difference does it make if you're using these individual coping strategies? Are they protective? Are those folks less food insecure as a result of using them? And how does that combination play out? So this is just a complex way of showing that. Okay. Thanks.
It was rolling.